The most amazing thing, the creator of heaven and earth, the God who delivered them out of Egypt, declares that he's going to enter into a covenant with these people. It's not a contract. It's a kind of binding agreement between things which couldn't possibly have any relation to one another, save for this kind of device, something which binds together God and man in a promise forever.
Dr. Kess, in our last discussion, we talked about some of the ways that you've read the book. We talked about some of the antecedents to the tale of the Israelites as we enter into Exodus from Genesis.
Right.
You've been studying this book, the book of Exodus, for teaching it for almost 20 years now. I wonder if there's a certain structure that suggested itself as you've now put your commentary together and that could guide the rest of our discussions.
No, thank you. The book of Exodus is really in three parts. The beginning part is the enslavement of the Israelites in Egypt, their experience there, and their deliverance. The central part is focused at Mount Sinai with the enactment of the covenant between God and Israel and the giving of the law, the Ten Commandments, followed by the ordinances. And the third part, often neglected in reading Exodus, but it turns out to be an equally important third, it has to do with the building of the tabernacle, a place where God is to abide among his people. And a small blip in that story, in that part, there is the story, the famous story of the golden calf and the conversation between God and Moses that follows. But basically, these three pieces. And it turns out that narrative structure of the book coincides with what I call the three pillars of the political foundation of the Israelite nation. The first part gives them the national narrative, which defines who they are and where they came from. The middle part gives them a guiding law that governs their life. And the third part answers to the human desire to be in touch with what is highest and best through the process of ritual worship communally.
Perhaps for this discussion, let's focus on that first of the three pillars.
Right.
The whole question of a story in which one sees oneself apart, that is somehow defines one's past and suggests a direction of the future. Why should that be important to a people?
Well, our identity is contrary to the belief of many people today, not self-created. We are not our own authors. We did not give birth to ourselves. We did not rear ourselves. Even in a liberal country like this, we are, from the beginning, informed by a culture, by a way of life that has certain kinds of teachings and experiences. Our identity is partly given to us by our inheritance and where we came from and where our parents came from and where the people who've taught us have come from and what they teach and what they believe. So a national story is, from the point of view of a nation, comparable to one's personal history and narrative and biography and the biography of one's forebears. And although the first part of Exodus is most famously celebrated for the dramatic deliverance of the children of Israel out of Egypt through the plagues and the work of God with Moses' help, I think it turns out that dramatic story, and I think one can show it from within the text, that dramatic story is, in fact, for the sake of the story, to be told generation after generation under command at the holiday of Passover.
So it would seem to suggest, thinking about the way you described the construction of the tabernacle and the purpose it plays, to be something that a nation looks up to together,
right,
that another purpose of a story like this one is that it should be something that a nation remembers together.
Exactly. Remembers and remembers with some deference, with some reverence, not without noticing its flaws or difficulties. And not everything that one sees in the mirror of one's own past is to be celebrated. But yes, this is a way in which a nation defines itself by its collective memory.
Now, the whole question of why this nation should be established in the political conditions of servitude is one of the giant questions which we'll have to confront. Maybe we should just enter into the text of Exodus now. How does it begin, and where does it point us towards?
Well, the very first chapter of Exodus moves from the children of Israel prospering, flourishing, procreating like swarming like insects. In Egypt, they're doing very, very well in the special place in Goshen where Joseph had established them in a privileged position. And by the end of the chapter, they are immiserated in an oppressive slavery by a new pharaoh who has whipped up animus against them amongst his people, sees them as threatening either in war or as likely to escape with all the talents that they bring to the regime. And at the end of the first chapter, Pharaoh is practicing infanticide upon the newborn babies. The transition begins with a pharaoh who knew not Joseph and who perhaps insecure in his new position sort of scapegoated these people, though they do constitute something of a problem as a nation of outsiders and not yet assimilated. And he's the first one to define them as a people. They've never referred to themselves as a people before. No one has referred to them as a people before. Their first identity is their collective victimization by a pharaoh who defines them as a people deserving of oppression.
Now, one of the effects of the text introducing the pharaoh and that identity in that way, a pharaoh arose who knew not Joseph, is that it also propels us forward in time so that it's not as if the children of Joseph have just passed away. It seems that we're in a new generation now.
We're a new generation.
Why should that be significant?
Well, it's significant for the children of Israel that while it says that there arose a pharaoh who knew not Joseph, it doesn't say anything about what the children of Israel remembered of their own ancestors.
Right.
And in fact, a chapter later, when finally the screws of oppression have been turned to the breaking point, they cry out. But it doesn't say they cried out to God. They just cried out. It was the first act that they themselves took was to scream from their misery. And then God hears them and remembers his covenant with Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. They don't somehow, I think, remember to whom they should turn. In fact, they'd have good reason for wondering, where is this God of our ancestors, if they knew him at all, who's been absent and out to lunch during this period of our oppression? So there's been a certain God-forgetting and possibly even a certain assimilation and a certain just loss of spirit on the part of these people under this oppression.
I mean, I think that's one of these key moments why the approach to reading that you take is so fruitful. Because as a reader, naively, we just heard from God not long ago. But trying to step into the dramatic environment of the text and inhabiting it along with the children of Israel oppressed in Egypt, they had not heard from God for perhaps many hundreds of years.
Yeah, the last word that God has said to any Hebrew in the text is he tells Jacob, don't be afraid to go down to Egypt. I will make of you a great nation there. God never speaks to Joseph, never. And Joseph, by the way, never prays. But the last word anybody's heard is that encouragement of Jacob, who doesn't want to go. But God encourages him to go and promises them this deliverance.
And so there's a real possibility that though we know about the covenant God has made with Jacob's family,
right?
Jacob's ancestors, excuse me, Jacob's descendants do not.
No. No, I think that's right. And I think you have, and I think one wants to focus on through this particular recognition of their forgetfulness, focus on why we start in slavery altogether. I mean, why? There are lots of ways to build a nation. Why not just put them in the land where they're supposed to be and let them grow naturally? Why the teeming in Egypt? Well, Egypt is, in fact, the fertile place. And they have the blessings of the fertility of the land, and they imitate the fertility of the land in their own reproduction and procreation. They're soon pushed to the bottom of the heap, and they're in a crushing form of slavery. It's not just involuntary servitude. I mean, it's arduous toil, ceaseless toil, all for Pharaoh's own personal benefit. And he's trying to break their procreative tendencies by more oppression, but the spirit resists, and eventually he's ready to kill their babies. Okay, so that's the situation. What's good about that for people formation? Well, first of all, they have a common enemy. And if they had previously been living their private lives, enjoying their own pursuits, now they are unified by being the victims of oppression. Second of all, they get a chance to see what Egypt is like in its extreme form, what this regime is like. And they get to experience what it means to be at the bottom of the heap, so that should they ever get to a position of being in command or control, they might be less likely to use their power to oppress others. Or if not less likely, at least they can be reminded, as they frequently are by God and Moses, remember that you were once slaves in the land of Egypt. Be kind to the stranger, the widows, the orphans, and the poor, so that they have some kind of experience of this. Third, precisely because of what we've just said, they've in a way been emptied out of any law or culture or remembrance. The only law they had to begin was the command to circumcise the sons on the eighth day. We don't know whether they practiced that in Egypt or not. We have no idea. But they don't have any way of life, and they have become a kind of blank slate on which something can be written. They lost their original prosperity in Egypt, and then they now have been put into a condition of having no culture of their own because they're simply victimized. But the most important thing, the last benefit of this, is if they get to be delivered, they will know who delivered them. This is not going to be by some slave revolt led by Spartacus, but they're going to be delivered by a mighty and awesome power that cares for them and that will bring them to him and give them a way of life that is the utter antithesis of the land in which they have suffered and from which they have suffered. So they get an experience of Egypt to become anti-Egypt. They learn what it means to suffer as a stranger in a strange land, and they will be oriented toward their deliverer. And when the time comes, that act of deliverance will bring them to attention so that they can get the law that they need to live by so that they can live a flourishing human life.
What are we to learn about Egypt and indeed about pharaonic rule, the rule of Pharaoh, from the injunction for the midwives of Egypt to carry out infanticide?
Yeah. Well, in the small, we saw at the end of Genesis that Egypt is, among other things, in battle with mortality itself. embalming magic in the search for principles that could produce reanimation. And one of the features of the tyrant, the definition of the tyrant, is he would like to be his own source and he would like to live forever. If we saw in Genesis that Pharaoh and Egypt is in the death-defying business, in Exodus 1 we see that Egypt means also the attempt to control birth. The magicians didn't do so well at immortality, and it turns out Pharaoh's attempt to control birth fails. The oppression doesn't stop the Israelites from procreating. On the contrary, they procreate almost in defiance of this or of his attempt to stop it. And when he tries to kill the babies, the midwives who feared the Lord or feared God, had a fear of heaven, as we would say, they refused to do this, as if somebody could expect midwives who are bringers of life to birth to be in the death-dealing business. And Pharaoh's plot comes a cropper because of the principle of woman, which is regeneration. I mean, the masculine principle is to try to control birth and death, and the women are resistant. And it really is through a series of five women that the beginning of this story and the resistance to Pharaoh's efforts is undermined. It's not just, I think, in the desire to control birth that the meaning of Egypt becomes terribly important. And I think we should say a few things about what is Egypt really, so that if we come to Israel as the anti-Egypt, we have a clear picture of what is to be overturned. The relation to birth and death we've already seen. Procreation in Israel is celebrated, and celebrated not just for itself, but as the vehicle for a transmission of a way of life which is elevating and not demoralizing and diminishing. Egypt.
We'll come to Egypt in a moment. I do want to just linger briefly.
Please.
Over the fact, and just ask what you make of it and what we should learn from the fact that the salvation of perhaps the most important Israelite in all of history is at the hands of a non-Jewish person, a person of impressive moral courage who defies the rule of the Pharaoh.
Yeah, well, I should say, first of all, there is a slight ambiguity about these midwives. They're called the Hebrew midwives, and it's not clear whether they are Egyptian women who are midwives to the Hebrews or whether they are themselves Hebrew women who happen to be midwives. My own inclination is the first, as you've suggested, that these are not Israelite women. Pharaoh wouldn't have expected Israelite women to kill their own babies. But it seems that there is something sort of innate in the affection for birth and generation that is the gift of women and the genius of women. When way back in Genesis, after the announcement of the so-called punishment for the transgression in the Garden of Eden, and Adam hears the litany of disaster that are in store from him, he latches on to the one hopeful thing that was pronounced when it was said to the woman, "In pain you will bear children, your desire shall be to your husband, he shall rule over you." And he renames the woman Chava, Eve. Why? Because she's the mother of all living. It is woman who contains within herself the antidote to mortality. And it resists the mastering impulse, the warlike impulse. One will see it again with the dance of the women after the song of the sea. The women are the partisans of life, of birth, of regeneration.
Indeed, in the beginning dramatic scenes of Exodus, we see these extraordinary five women,
right,
on whose shoulders the fate of the Jewish people is carried.
Exactly. Not just the two midwives, but if one can peek over into the second chapter, we have the birth of this baby to a husband, a man and woman who were in a way defying the edict. And the mother saw that this baby was good. She hid him for 3 months, and when she couldn't hide him any longer, she put him in the river and put his sister there to watch. And I think these were very cunning women. This was not just any spot in the river where abandoned this baby in a little ark, a word that's not been used since Noah's Ark, where the river might be kind to it. She put it in the place where she knew certain high royal people would come to bathe. And it turns out Pharaoh's daughter comes down there, finds, here's the baby crying. This baby is the only baby that cries in the whole Hebrew Bible. This little baby cries, attracts the attention of this woman. And while the mother might have been, out of love of her own, protecting this baby, the woman who turns out to be Pharaoh's daughter takes compassion on this child, even though it's a Hebrew child, and defying her father's edict, which would have required the drowning of this baby, takes him into the palace and adopts him as her son. Astounding. And it is these five women who are the protectors and preservers of life. And in fact, look, Pharaoh's edict is turned against him by his own daughter, who in defying the edict brings into the palace the figure who's going to bring him down. Bring down actually the next Pharaoh, but never mind the pharaonic rule.
Okay, now let's return to the question that you've posed, that you think the text poses to us, which is, what is Egypt? Help us understand the nature and characteristics of this place, this regime, this way of life.
Okay, I think part we talked about last time, Egypt is the place that reveres the Nile, which is the source of its fertility. Egypt is a place that reveres the sun, which many places do before the coming of the Hebrew Bible. Look to the sun as a god. Ra is high in the Egyptian pantheon. And between the regularity of the river and the sun, Egypt is a place where nature is, at least in part, looked to as beneficent, powerful, and to be revered. There are many nature gods in Egypt. At the same time, however, nature is very uncooperative in several important particulars, namely mortality. And so it's not that we simply revere nature and take our lumps, but there's a certain sense that Egypt recognizes that, yes, we think that these cosmic beings are beautiful, they move with regularity, but in some way we are not really at home here in the decisive respect, and it's up to us to try to do something about it. And the magicians and the science and the sorcerers and the technologists. Egypt is a place of administration, technology, science, architecture, art. It's very, very sophisticated. They're at work trying to do something to promote health and especially longevity.
Now show us where you derive that in the text.
Where does one see that? Well, the first place you see it, actually, it's a very small point, but when old Jacob is brought by Joseph before Pharaoh, the first question out of Pharaoh's mouth to Jacob is, how old are you? Because Jacob is older than Pharaoh. The golden age in Egypt is 110, and I believe, I've forgotten exactly, but I think Jacob says to him, I think very cunningly, he says, long and sorrowful have been my years. Don't envy me. There is also, this is not so much only from the text, but the Egyptians, the Israelites are bearded, the Egyptians are clean shaven, and the heads are shaven, and it's as if one should remove any sign of aging or change The blemishes should be removed. Either changeless change, such as the eternal return of the cycle, but better the arresting of change altogether. And it's also reflected in the hieroglyph, which is a capturing permanently through static visual representations of the motile world. Egypt is a place of technology, and it's one of its great achievements, not just the Great Pyramid, which contains all kinds of secret teachings, but really in these magical arts. And one sees later on in Exodus that Pharaoh's magicians are at least able to match Moses through the first of the two plagues. Egypt, as I said, is polytheistic, and not just the heavenly bodies in the river, but lots of animals. The bull is sacred because it's the emblem of male potency. The cow is sacred because she's the emblem of maternal care. Frogs are sacred because they represent fertility. The scarab, the dung beetle, is sacred because the dung beetle produces life that comes out of the dung, and it therefore is the emblem of immortality. But in all of this polytheism, the standing of the human being in the cosmic reckoning is very small. Man is not in the image of God. Man is a kind of cosmic orphan, which, if you think about it long enough and hard enough in Egypt, you're going to say, we have to do something. We can't simply rely on these nature gods. We have to do something about it. And what we do is partly technology and magic, but mostly what we do to deal with the orphan character and weakness of the human is we find a powerful human being who will rule. And the decisive thing for the story is the politics of Egypt, where one man rules as if he were a god, is treated and acknowledged by the god, and everybody else counts for less than nothing at all. So what you really have here is where strangers are mistreated, they have no standing. So you have a place which, on the one hand, looks like it looks to the cosmos, but really recognizes the cosmological indifference to the human being, where we rely really on our own powers to try to do something about it. But finally, we return to one man as master, whom we hope can be the true benefactor of us. And it turns out that the story, as will be revealed here, is the reliance upon a man made to be a god to men will be the engine of everybody's destruction.
Let's now enter back into the narrative of the text of Exodus. Moses, as you've just been saying, has been saved. One does not yet really have warrant to say miraculously, but Moses has nevertheless been saved. He is nursed by his mother, his birth mother. We don't meet Moses again until some years later. In our first discussion, Leon, you mentioned that you would try to pay attention not only to the things that are said in the text, but to the lacunae in the text.
Right.
This would seem to be of decisive importance. What do you make of it?
Yes, we have Moses goes into the palace after he's been weaned. And the next thing we know, Moses is out of the palace, and he has these three episodes that are reported about young man Moses encountering strife. The Egyptian taskmaster beating a Hebrew slave, two brawling Hebrews, and then he flees to Midian and he rescues the daughters of Reuel or Jethro, the priest of Midian, from the bullying shepherds who are harassing them at the well. But in between, Moses spends 15 years in Pharaoh's house, and there's not a peep about it. I think two things to say. Officially, the text wants us to know. We've learned about the miserable condition of the people. we've introduced to this guy Moses. He must be important for some reason. We will find out later. He's going to be God's agent and champion with Pharaoh and with the people and so on. But for now, he's a guy. He's gone into Pharaoh's house, and the text wants us to know something about his character, which we see in the stories that follow. And he's revealed as a person who has a sense of fellow feeling, doesn't like to see underdogs bullied, will insert himself actively into affairs, doesn't care very much about his own interest. He's a man of action and so on. That's what the text wants us to know. And that looks like something important for what one can do if one needs a leader. Here's a guy who's got certain moral qualities. Those episodes, by the way, all fail, or two of them fail, but never mind for the moment. But the question is, what's he learning in Pharaoh's house that might be also important? And why, if he turns out to be one of the agents of their deliverance, can he not just arise from the mass of the slaves as Spartacus does in the Roman story? I think it's because God is interested in having as a champion not just somebody who doesn't like injustice and will be a man of action, but who has an interest in the truth of things, who wants to know what's really so. So my speculation is Moses is getting a princely education. He's learning to ride the chariot and to shoot the bow, but he's learning mathematics, in which the Egyptians are very strong, physics, astronomy, but also metaphysics, the secret teachings, what the magicians know. And he is getting what one would call, if it were not, if it were in Greece, a philosophical education. And that becomes important, which we can probably talk about another time when we talk about how God catches Moses.
The whole question of the character and subsequent leadership of Moses, maybe we should save for its own discussion, so integral to the whole text. But there are some things we'll have to note along the way,
right,
even as we defer the largest, more decisive analysis of that question to another time. Zooming ahead, you've mentioned that Moses must, for reasons of his own conviction, flee Egypt. He comes to a place called Midian. What's important for us to know about that place?
Well, Midian is a place which is, I think, important in the story because of the influence of his father-in-law. Moses rescues these women at the well. They come home early because they manage to get, he waters their sheep for them. They rush home. Their father says, "How come you're here so early?" He says, this Egyptian guy, he helped us out at the well. And the father says, "What, you didn't bring him home?" He brings Moses home. Moses dwells with Reuel, subsequently called Jethro, and he gives him one of his daughters to wife. And Moses settles there and becomes a shepherd tending the sheep of his father-in-law, who is the priest of Midian. And we don't know anything about this, but one thinks that Moses is being given something in addition to the Egyptian princely education. He's given perhaps a different kind of theological orientation, or at least, as he names his son Gershon, because I was a stranger in a strange land. And does he mean only Egypt, or does he mean also here? Moses, I think, as a result of these experiences, might be turned toward a concern with the divine and eternal things, but feeling in some way restless and lost. So that when the story finally turns, it's because he's wandering with the flock of his father-in-law's sheep to the edge of the wilderness, to this mountain. And my sense is Moses is somehow searching. He's restless. He's looking for something. Ancestors, God, no, God only knows what he's looking for. And he's in a way ripe for the catching because of his character, his education in Egypt, and his time with his father-in-law. These are all preparatory things for the great turning around of Moses, which is at the burning bush.
You have reason to believe that Moses received something like a philosophical education in the court of Egypt. So now, when we get to the burning bush, tell us, let's pick up there. What does Moses see, and what moves him?
This is really one of the most magnificent stories, and it's a pivotal story for the whole text. Moses is wandering, as I say, with the flock, and he sees a bush, bramble in the wasteland, in the desert, aflame, but not only burning, with burning things in the desert, not so uncommon, but this burning bush is not exhausted, and the flame doesn't go out, and the bush is not destroyed. And Moses turns aside to see why the bush is not consumed. Moses is he's the first of the patriarchs to ask the question why. Moses goes, following his eyes to a mystery, seeking the cause. It's a very Egyptian thing.
I want to unpack that for a moment.
Please.
We spoke at some length in our previous discussion about Abraham's hearing God's call. That would seem to be an important contrast here.
Yeah, no, I mean, to make a long story telegraphically short, the way of humankind is primarily to trust to sight, and the mind following the eyes to take in the look of things, to their ideas, perhaps to grasp their meaning because you think you know them, because you can name them in their wholeness and so on. And the beginning of Genesis is, in fact, an attack on following our eyes to what we think is highest. By our own nature, we're left to turn our eyes aloft and notice these powerful, beautiful, eternally circling things that give light and warmth and so on. Whereas the reader of the story is being told that behind that beautiful sight, there is an intelligence which addresses us and it through speech. Same with Abraham. But it really comes to a head here in Egypt. Moses, taking the epitome of the way of seeing, seeing in the hieroglyph, seeing in worshiping the sun, seeing in a concern with the beautiful things. Moses goes to see and to know through the sight what the cause is. And he's arrested by a voice, the messenger of God, speaking to him from out of the bush. And he calls him by name, Moses, Moses. And like anybody who would be so addressed, Moses says, "Here I am. Speak to me. I'm all ears." And the voice says, "I am the God of your fathers, the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, and the God of Jacob." First he says, "Tell them, take off your shoes, for you're on sacred ground." Then he tells them this. And Moses covers his eyes and is afraid to look upon God. This is the conversion from wonder to awe, from following your eyes to hearkening to a voice. A voice that you know is present, but you cannot see, you cannot take the measure of it. You cannot pretend to know it. You will know only so much of it as it chooses to tell you. And the reaction is, this is the classic story of the experience of awe, which is at the heart of the Jewish way. It is that for which Abraham was praised for awe and reverence before God. It's not like terror, in which you are afraid and turn around and run away. But awe holds you at a certain distance. You'd like to approach it, but no, you want to move away from it, but it still attracts you. And by the experience of awe acknowledges the great gulf between you and the awesome thing. But by feeling awe, you've established a relationship with it across this great chasm so that it's not just terrifying. It holds you. It invites you. You can't grasp it, but it attracts you and you're interested in it. This is the conversion of Moses Egyptian to Moses Proto-Israelite, where his stance in the world is no longer going to be entirely through his eyes, but through hearkening. And the hearkening, of course, comes all the way forward. Hear, O Israel, and do not forget what you heard at Sinai, lest you turn your eyes to heaven and worship those things aloft. Deuteronomy in the retelling. But this is the episode, and any reader who's following along and is sort of experiencing this with Moses is going to be arrested at this point.
Now, here's a place where the reader following along in the text, it seems to me, would have a different experience than Moses.
Please.
Inasmuch as we, the readers, again, we know of these figures, Moses' fathers, Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. But how do we know that Moses does?
Now, why is Moses arrested by this? I don't think Moses knows anything about Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. I don't think he does. But if Moses has longings for the God of Israel, he doesn't know his father. He's been adopted in the palace, presided over by the three women, not by his father. Father disappears after having taken the wife. Moses might have a longing for his father. Mm-hmm. Moses might have an interest in knowing God. Moses might have a just sort of restlessness. And here, out of the wilderness, a voice calls him by name. Something out there knows me personally. And he speaks that he was the being worshipped by my father. And, oh, by these names, who are these names? They must be my ancestors. This is awesome. I mean, in the literal meaning. And if I'm a restless person hungering for some kind of contact with what's really highest, if I feel lost, if I want to know what is my why, I feel my life is supposed to be about something, and someone summons me by name and puts and says that I'm the heir of a certain relationship with these mystic figures. I don't yet who know they are. Boy, I'm going to pay attention.
In that way, doing for Moses what you've discovered the narrative does for the construction of the people.
Yes.
In rooting Moses in this particular past, it's something like what happens to the eventual formation of the people is done by that people's being rooted in the story that we're now discovering in their deliverance from Egypt.
That's true, but something else has to happen to make the people ready to have Moses' experience. It's the Sinai experience primarily where the people are somehow turned around. And for that, they need not just the narrative, but they need the actual acts of deliverance, which is where this story is headed.
The entire episode of Moses at the burning bush could take a conversation unto itself.
Yeah.
We probably should press on. There is the need for Moses to bring the people out of Egypt. But that's not easily done. If you just put yourself in Moses' shoes and try to think about how one could try to accomplish that, it's not obvious. That might be part of why Moses is so hesitant to undertake this assignment from God in the first place.
He's very hesitant. I mean, God gives them this long mission, and he says, who am I to do this? I mean, what power do I have? And you can do all of that. What do you need me for? And are these my people? Why should I be bothered? And God says to them, he says, I will be with you. Don't worry. I've got your back, and I'm going to be doing this. And also, your identity, Moses, you want to know who you are, Moses? You're the one with whom I will be. Then Moses says, Well, when I come to the people and I tell them that so-and-so has sent me to take you out of Egypt and they want to know your name, what shall I tell them? And here Moses is, I think, you're going to be with me? Well, okay, who are you so that I can trust this voice? And God answers Moses' question for the divine name with an enigma. I will be what I will be. Don't ask for my name, Moses. That's not the relation here. Pay attention. We will show you who I am. And then Moses says, but look, the people, they won't listen to me. And he says, well, we're going to, various signs and wonders will convince them. And then, but I'm not a good speaker. And he says, well, but I will be with your mouth. And Moses throws up his hands and says, oh, send whomever you send. And God gets angry with him and then assigns Aaron the job and then gives them instructions. How are you going to do this? He tells them the whole story. You're going to go to Pharaoh. You're going to ask him to let people go. And he's not going to listen to you for a long time until I stretch out my mighty arm and outstretched hand and I'm going to take them out. So Moses is told in advance a little drama that has to take place. Moses first goes to the people and performs these signs and wonders, a few of them, and they sign on completely. And drunk on this success, Moses and Aaron and the elders who peel off go to see Pharaoh and say, look, the God of the Israelites has told us, let the people go out and Pharaoh says, I know not Yud-Heh-Vav-Heh, Yahweh. I don't know him. I'm not going to listen to you. And then he turns the screws. The situation gets worse. The oppression of the people is greater. The people remonstrate with Moses. And Moses himself is in despair. And now God tells him the whole story. Here's how it's going to be. Here's about the plans for the deliverance. Here, I'm going to take you to me. Here's the business of the land. And Moses, we're going to go through a process in which we're going to have a series of signs, wonders, and chastisements, which you will perform. They will not succeed. But on the last one, I will come in and we'll get them out.
Some of the language, even in your repetition of the story, attentive listeners will have heard the going back and forth between the people's needing to see signs and wonders.
Right.
And Moses saying, perseverating about his ability to speak,
right,
to be heard.
Right.
Somehow Moses understanding and God understanding this, these two different modalities of experiencing the world.
Right.
We should move ahead to try to understand the theological and political contest between God
and
Moses and Pharaoh. But before we do that, I want to just step inside the Pharaoh's mentality. As the Pharaoh says, I know not this God. Well, doesn't that make sense?
It of course makes sense. It of course makes sense. And there's this large population of slaves. They're very valuable to the regime. He doesn't want to lose them. Here's a guy claiming he's got some supernatural power on his side. Why should I listen to him? And he has his armies. They slaves, two spokespersons. Doesn't look very good. And if he yielded, it would look weak. And he has a real political problem. He doesn't, I think it through. And the consequences of his intransigence turns out to destroy his own people. But that is, in a way, part what is exposed in the story is part of the meaning of being Pharaoh, rather than a true leader of a people who acts for their benefit rather than his own.
Of course, there's a theological dimension to that, too. It makes sense, given everything that Pharaoh thinks about the world,
right,
knows about the world, that those people have their gods in their place, and those people, other people have their other gods. And I've never heard of that other god.
Right.
And so the fact that that god is calling you people, to worship him there,
yep,
that's none of my business.
Right.
He's not, that God is not sovereign here.
Right.
Where I am.
Very good. Yep. Absolutely.
So that would seem to be necessary background for us to then step into the theological dimension of this confrontation.
Right. Yeah. You mean with the plagues?
Yes.
Yeah. Look, the signs, they're almost never called plagues. They're called signs, wonders, wonders, signs, and chastisement. Wonder is a spectacle to the eye. The sign is to read the spectacle for its meaning, and the chastisements are they are at the same time punitive for certain misconduct. And through a series of wonders, or we'll call them the plagues that are of increasing severity, a certain affliction takes place on the land of Egypt, getting worse and worse, even turning lots of the people and even his courtiers against Pharaoh. But Pharaoh becomes more and more resistant. With each plague, as long as the plague lasts, Pharaoh is increasingly cowed and says, "You can go." But when the plague is halted on Moses' request of God, out of sight, out of mind, Pharaoh goes back to his old position, and the problem is gone. I shouldn't have to deal with this further. The plagues are a whole series of things at once. They are, first of all, a weakening of the regime to make it easier to get the children of Israel out. And they are a form of encouraging the Israelites to see that, there is a power that's competing with Pharaoh here and we should pay attention. We don't speak to them during this whole period of the plagues, but at the end when Moses tells them to go out, they no longer are hesitant. They're going. They see that not only is there a power that's acting here, but this is a power that has some intelligence because the power is discriminatory. The plagues affect every place but where the Israelites are. And eventually on the 10th plague, God will go over the houses and slay the firstborn in each house that isn't marked. What kind of natural power can go into a house and distinguish the firstborn from the other? This is a God of intelligence and discernment. The plagues are an attack both on the theology and cosmology of Egypt and on its politics. The plagues rise from the water, the blood, and the frogs, to the land, the dust, and the gnats and the flies, to the living creatures, the beasts, and then the beasts and the human beings, then upward to the locusts and the hail, to things that come out of the heavens that destroy the crops, and finally the darkness and the extinction of the sun and the death of the future and the firstborn. One is working one's way up the Egyptian pantheon, and one sees that God is mightier than all of these and is not just an indiscriminate force like Poseidon and other natural powers. In the end, because Pharaoh at each point has been strengthened to stay the course, we also expose the full meaning of pharaonic or despotic politics. In order to stave face and to maintain his power as the mighty man of Egypt, and he's not folded his cards, Pharaoh is willing to see the complete destruction of his land, including the death of firstborn in every one of his households, including his own. So that the plagues reveal not only the truth about the non-godlikeness of the gods worshipped in Egypt, but also the non-politics of the politics of a despotic ruler like Pharaoh. This is a ruler who does not rule in the interests of his people, but his rule means the destruction of the entire regime for which he's responsible.
Now, since the reappearance of God at the burning bush, God is back in the drama of this story in a decisive way. Of course, God is doing these things that we've been talking about, creating the manifold wonders that are in contest with Pharaoh. But God also reveals certain other actions that God's undertaking, such as the toughening of Pharaoh's heart. What does one make of that?
Yeah, this is a vexed question, and most people who read this have a great deal of difficulty with it. It looks as if Pharaoh is ready to quit, and then God hardens Pharaoh's heart and makes him obstinate, and then punishes him for being obstinate. What kind of a willful and irrational and nasty God is this who's playing with Pharaoh like a cat plays with a mouse? That's not right, I don't think. First of all, the Hebrew word that gets translated in the King James as hardening the heart is strengthening or giving weight to. There's only one of the three verbs that's used that could be possibly translated as hardening. What God is doing is strengthening Pharaoh's heart when Pharaoh is disheartened. And the contest wouldn't be the contest it has to be if Pharaoh isn't helped to be Pharaoh 100% of what he would think, do, and say. For this contest to be meaningful, Pharaoh has to be at the absolute top of his game, never yielding on his powers, never yielding on his ways, so that the victory will mean something, so that the witness of Pharaoh's defeat itself will mean something, and so that the people will actually see the meaning of pharaonic politics and the alternative that's to be rejected. God helps. Some of the time the text says Pharaoh strengthened his own heart, but sometimes, look, you or I get despondent, and we're just down and out. And somehow, we can't even give ourselves a pep talk to strengthen our own heart. But somehow, something flies in from the outside, God knows how, and we get our resolution back. That's what I take these things to be. A force sort of brought Pharaoh back from discouragement, and Pharaoh played Pharaoh to the bitter end.
Now there's also the disclosure about why it is that God requires this to unfold the way that it does.
Yeah. Look, this is absolutely crucial. Most people read the story of Exodus and the deliverance as a story of national liberation. The word freedom, the Hebrew words for freedom, don't occur in the text at all. And God says most emphatically that the reason he is doing all of these things is so that the Egyptians shall know that I am the Lord. The contest is only marginally or partly about getting the Egyptians, the Israelites, out of Egypt. You could do that in any kind of way. But the long protracted contest through the plagues and the final deliverance has an epistemic purpose. It has a knowledge purpose, so that the Egyptians shall know the Lord of Israel is God. And when the Egyptians know it, then the Israelites will be much more inclined to believe it. So the sequel turns out to be crucial to bring the Egyptians as witnesses for the Israelites to discover it. And this is what takes place at the sea.
So that the ultimate purpose of this contest should not be circumscribed by even the crucially important immediate politics of the deliverance, but for the sake of the identity of this people in the future.
Exactly. And before they go out of Egypt, on the night of going out of Egypt, before they go out, they're given the commandment to commemorate this going out of Egypt every year hereafter in perpetuity. It's as if this deliverance is for the sake of being remembered in the stories told by parents to children generation after generation. And the story will be the story not just of liberation, but of the source of that deliverance. The source of that deliverance. So all of that politics is to have a story of deliverance can become the foundation of a new relationship with the divine, which will then give them a teaching for how they can live better than even the Egyptians lived. And this, it has its dramatic culmination when Pharaoh the next morning after they've gone out decides, oh my God, I look like I'm weak. We've got to chase after them. There's a long story at the Sea of Reeds we don't have time to go into, but in the end, the waters part. Israel puts its toe in the water and goes through without drowning. Pharaoh and his 600 chariots go in. Afterwards, the waters close. The Egyptians drown. And the last word you hear from the Egyptians as they're drowning say, it's impossible. The Lord fights for them. And so the last witness of the drowning Egyptians is the Egyptians announced to the watching Israelites the superiority and supremacy of the God of whom Pharaoh said in the beginning, I don't know him.
That's the last time we hear from Egypt.
It's the last word of Egypt until Chronicles.
We've been speaking about the story and its essential purpose for forming a people. But this part of Exodus also crucially includes a song. Tell us about that.
Well, I mean, the children of Israel watch on the shore as the Egyptian army drowns in the Sea of Reeds. And they see the bodies littering, washed up. And it says, and they believed in the Lord and in his servant Moses. That's the end of that story. And the very next verse, Exodus 15, begins, and the children of Israel, Moses and the children of Israel sang. And there is now the song of the sea, which I think is composed by Moses, and the children sing along miraculously. It's a song of the sea which follows immediately upon the spectacle of what's been witnessed. And it's a triumphalist song in which Moses, who is now trusted by the people, it was, after all, Moses' staff which parted the waters as far as the people could see. They didn't see what God was doing. Moses turns their trust to him entirely to God and sings a song of praise to the Almighty who has delivered them. And the mantra is given them in the midst of this song, who is like you among the gods? And what is the purpose of this song? This is a first, apart from putting their toe in the water, this is the first sort of collective. They've had a kind of, as it were, baptismal birth walking through the waters. They're on the other side of the waters. And now Moses gives them a story to unite them in song and celebration, to tell them the meaning of what they've just witnessed, because what they've just witnessed will disappear like all sights do, but the song persists along with the story. He interprets them by passing the meaning of this from him to God, and he sings them courageous in this story by telling them the other peoples have already heard this and are afraid. We can go forward. One of the problems we didn't mention about the advantages of starting with slavery are, as I mentioned, the disadvantages is you've got a slavish people, slavish in heart and mind, and who are not yet ready to fight and not yet ready for self-government. And Moses now has managed to get them through here with God's help, but he now needs to sing them courageous for the things that are coming around the corner, including battle with the Amalekites and other kinds of dangers.
Well, perhaps that's an occasion for us to bring this part of our discussion to a close and anticipate what is to come. For if the Israelites have been redeemed from Egypt and therefore have this story of their redemption as something that puts in store a common memory, they don't yet have a way of life that redeems them from the slavish attitudes that had been inculcated in Egypt. That's to come.
That's to come, and it comes very quickly and in the next few episodes. Look, they've been delivered from Egypt. There come three episodes, episodes about their murmurings about food and water, the attack of the Amalekites, and the visit of Moses' father, Jethro, where he talks to him about law. These three stories have to do with the three essential things of a new founded nation: meeting necessities for food and water, being able to defend yourself against enemies, and internal regulation through law. These three episodes precede the actual great event of the covenant and the giving of the law, but they show us, if one goes through them carefully, the need for what's coming. The people are restive, and when they're short food and water, they dream of going back to Egypt, where, although they were slaves, there was lots of meat in the pot.
Or so they remember.
What?
Or so they remember.
Or so they remember. And so it seems better. Look, the call of freedom, the call of plenty is for many people worth a certain amount of servility. And it's a big job to getting the slaves out of Egypt was easy. Getting Egypt out of the slaves is a project for the rest of the Torah.
Let's pick up there next time.
Thanks.
Dr. Cass, thank you.
Thanks, John.